My name's Roger Yates. I'm 72. I've written all my life. I come from a generation of the British beat poets. I suppose the most famous of our group was Lee Harwood, Chris Torrance, Barry McSweeney, those people back in the 60s. So we were in this kind of little mag scene. So I've published in that.
But there's not much of a little magazine scene around anymore, is there? So there's poets out there, but they're not necessarily getting into print.
Yeah, I think so, although they're probably perhaps publishing online and or they have blogs. There's quite a powerful poetry scene, I think, in Bristol. There are poetry readings. I don't ever get involved with it myself.
What were you writing about in the 60s and 70s then?
We were writing poetry. We just naturally felt that we were poets. Poetry was the rock and roll of that period, really.
Well, I suppose it managed to find its way into song lyrics and all sorts of things, didn't
it?
But
yes,
what was your muse? What were you kind of, you know, what was your inspiration?
Well, personally, people like T.S. Eliot and Shakespeare and high culture poetry, but we were also writing within the kind of context of the Beat Generation, people like Allen Ginsberg, that group.
Gary Snyder, Jack
Gary
Kerouac.
Snyder, exactly, yeah. And Jack Kerouac, yeah.
And, but I mean, they were writing a lot, I think it's fair to say, a lot about social change and social justice because the 60s, the Summer of Love, I mean, is that where you were too?
In a way, yes, but I suppose I step back towards the Beat Generation, really.
Yes, I suppose the Beat Generation is before all that.
Oh, no, I was never a very good hippie.
Post-war, more post-war than 60s, or not?
Well, perhaps some artier is the point. The hippies were rock and roll people. My generation were listening to jazz. We were listening to John Coltrane. We were listening to Charles Mingus. I personally felt that rock and roll was corporate music. I got into rock and roll really with the Beatles. In funny circumstances, I was living in Macau in a hotel.
Where's that?
Macau. It's opposite Hong Kong. It's on the Chinese mainland. It's now part of China, but it was a Portuguese colony, so I was living there and listening every day, all day, to A Hard Day's Night by the Beatles, being played by a little girl selling orange juice down below my hotel window.
So you were weaned onto
onto the Beatles.
Rock and roll.
I was weaned onto rock and roll by a Chinese girl, yeah.
Amazing. So I think for those that haven't really come across the Beat Generation much, because it certainly isn't really being acknowledged as important as it was, you know, I think the impact that it had at the time isn't now. What was it about? What was the Beat? What made someone part of the Beat Generation?
That's kind of difficult to say. I suppose it was most simply, I mean, it was the thing that was happening. Writers like William Burroughs were very important, and On the Road, of course, by Jack Kerouac, which I think is a truly awful book, and I'm very unpopular with my old Beat friends for saying so, but I mean it did have a big impact. You know, it was a kind of poetic dystopia. There was something very unique in that.
But it was definitely an antidote to the sort of settled lifestyle, everything being nice and clean cut, reliable income every week, a sort of American dream style home, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, that's what it set out. That's what it said it was doing, yeah. But I think it's actually a very, very conservative book, On the Road. It's all about America, after all.
Yeah, but I mean, that's where he was. It's difficult for him to write about Kerouac, to write about other places when that's where he's you know, experiencing a lot of things that are going on. I mean, he was part of a scene over there which was very much to do with the experimenting with drug culture and challenging social norms.
Yes, it was, yes.
What was the equivalent? Was there an equivalent in Britain?
Yes, absolutely, definitely. In fact, if you think about it, Bob Dylan came really to Britain as to the source when he wanted to discover our folk music scene. So Britain was quite important in that kind of way. Whether we actually had the, I mean, we had the writers, you know, and but then they weren't so famous or, you know, as the American writers were, particularly people like Ginsberg. Corso, that lot.
So more recently, you've been writing a book, first of all, I think, one you published last year, is The Beautiful Season, the story of the Spanish Revolution.
Yes.
A story of the Spanish Revolution.
Yes.
What's that about?
It's about the Spanish Revolution.
Oh, yes.
But in
the Civil War?
No. I mean, I think there's a difference. I'd seen a very marvellous documentary called Living Utopia. It's in Spanish, but it's well subtitled. It's got marvelous music, flamenco music and Spanish music. It was interviews with the anarchists of the Spanish Revolution of 1936, when they were all in their 80s, maybe. And it was truly inspiring. I mean, I knew about the Spanish Civil War, as we call it. I knew there'd been an anarchist revolution, but I knew very little about it. And so I ended up reading histories and just getting into the subject for about 6 months. I read a lot of stuff. And then, suffering from insomnia, I got up one night at 2 o'clock and started writing. And I finished the book more or less in one draft. It is in one draft, actually, in 3 weeks and 2 days.
Okay, so that's in less than a month. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen the Ken Loach film Land and Freedom about the Spanish Revolution, Civil
yes.
War, whatever you want to call it. But it did seem that the anarchists at the end of the Civil War were, sorry, the revolution, were stitched up. So
yes,
they didn't
absolutely.
Actually get their revolution. So
they
aspired to have a revolution.
Quite.
But as so often happens,
yes.
the dreams were dashed at the last minute.
Well, they were dashed before the last minute.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, the revolution was betrayed by absolutely everybody. But what I wanted to write about, I mean, the Civil War, I've said it in that book, and it's perhaps it's a point of view, but the Civil War was really a fight, and this is a right-wing point of view, unfortunately. It was a fight between Stalin and the fascists. If the Republic, who everybody fates as being, you know, for democracy, that old story, if the Republic had won, there would have been a Stalinist dictatorship in Spain. And if, as Franco won, there was a fascist dictatorship in Spain. So it made very little difference. The story that was interesting was the fact that the workers rose up in 1936, and they actually precipitated, if you like, the Spanish Civil War, because it's my view that that Franco would have taken Spain in 2 or 3 weeks. He was absolutely unopposed. The army and the police were all going over to Franco. The government had collapsed, and into this power vacuum, and this always happens, the same thing has happened, for example, in Syria with the Rojava Kurds in the absence of government. The same thing happened in the subject of my second book, which is the Paris Commune. You know, when government disappears, people rise up and very effectively manage things for themselves. And that's what happened in Spain, although it has to be said, there was a huge anarchist movement, millions of people in syndicalist trade unions, the CNT, CNT. They'd been practicing for this for 20 years. So they literally took over northern Spain very, very quickly, drove the army out, and collectivized in a way that never happened in the Soviet Revolution. Nothing like that happened. They completely collectivized. In many places, they did away even with money. Orwell was there. The book to read, don't read my book, read Homage to Catalonia, which is a very, very marvelous book. Orwell was there slightly after the period that I write about. I write about the 4 months of the full revolution. Until one of the, I don't like to use the word in an anarchist context, but one of the leaders, Buenaventura Durruti, was killed in Madrid, and the funeral of Durruti. So I cover that period from the revolution on the in July, on the 19th of July, through to the 20th of November, that 4 month period.
So was the revolution something that was sort of the sandwich in between Franco and Stalin? I mean, are you one of these people that thinks that that fascism and the Soviet-style communism were two kind of similar
things?
They're
the same thing, yeah.
Were the same thing? Really?
Yeah. Well, they're very similar. You know, they're both tyrannies. They have nothing to do whatever with socialism. National socialism has nothing to do with socialism except the name. And Stalinism and even Leninism had, in my view, but I'm an anarchist, you know. It's all explained in the book if you want to read it.
That's actually nothing
to do with socialism.
That's a hotly contested point, but I come across more and more people that convince me that actually it's almost like these two opposites are set up in a country that's in turmoil, and people are attracted to one side or the other, but actually the best thing to do is not to be attracted to either side.
Well,
there's a lot
of
pressure on people if you're going to fight, if there's a fight going on, to choose a side.
Well, there is, but the fight happened later. I mean, as Orwell, let's quote Orwell because everybody respects and trusts him. Orwell said the anarchists chased Franco out of Aragon. He was there shortly afterwards. He was amazed. It completely informed, in my view, the rest of his life. Orwell was an anarchist. And he was completely amazed at what he saw and heartwarmed by what he saw going on in Barcelona, which was really slightly after the high period.
Did any of these ideals last after the Spanish Civil War?
Yes. No. Some people were fighting Franco. Anarchists never gave up. They were in the hills and they fought Franco until, I think, 1967. So that was going on. Some of the ideals translated across to, for example, free school education. The modern schools of Paco Ferrer were created also in America, and I suppose Summerhill, the free school, has got a lot to do with that. The feminism of the Spanish Revolution, an organization called Mujeres Libres, Free Women. They were very, very advanced people, and we've forgotten about it.
What about the Pyrenees? Because I imagine that some of the sorts of ideals and ways of doing things, ways of working, might survive there. It's a little bit away from the cities and a little bit uncontrolled.
I don't think so. I think Franco really thoroughly obliterated that revolution. I do think that it possibly was the last chance for revolution in our society or in our history. I don't want to be too negative about
what
things.
Would you say were the lessons in terms of ideas, the positive ideas that came out of all that?
Well, the notion of anarchism is that you run society from the bottom without a state, without a party, through civil society organizations, specifically in Spain. These were through big trade unions. So after the revolution drove the army out, people simply went back to work. They then negotiated with the bosses. A lot of them ran away to France, but some of them stayed to say, well, okay, it's fine, you can stay, you get equal pay with everybody else. We have meetings about this, and it worked fine. People say, you know, don't be under the impression that the Spanish Revolution failed because it was an idealistic utopia and those kind of things never worked. I mean, how long it would have worked is another matter, because Spain was a divided society. I suppose over 50% of the people had anarchist ideals, and they would probably have won an election. It's very difficult to change things.
But would it be difficult to persuade them to vote in an election as their anarchists?
Well, they had voted. They voted in some elections, they didn't vote in others. All of that was decided through meetings that were structured federally from the bottom up, and huge meetings, you know, of the trade unions, of the CNT. It was very democratic. It worked. Agricultural, for example, agricultural production went up by 30%. When the Bolsheviks, shall we call them, the communists, who are basically the bourgeoisie, agricultural production went up, industrial production improved. Ford's in Barcelona was retooled to make aircraft engines. The railways ran, the hospitals worked, everything worked. If you don't believe me, read Orwell.
What about, it's a basic fact here that without the state, how on earth are you going to stop someone coming along, the next tyrant coming on, taking over? You've got to have some sort of structure to defend whatever it is you've decided you want to do, haven't you?
Well, that's the standard sort of critique of revolution, isn't it? That you either it's the notion that you have to have some kind of authoritarian government. But that wasn't the case in Spain. People organized themselves. They wanted to do it. It has to be said, and it has to be said that you wouldn't want to have been a priest. And the bourgeoisie were fine. I mean, they had their cars commandeered, but they pretty soon, as Orwell noticed, started using familiar forms of speech and dressing like workers. And they seem to have been, you know, it was a...
Why do people have it in for the priests then? Because, I mean, we've seen over the years, quite often, I mean, for example, in South America, the Catholic Church has been the only conduit for human rights. Pretty much everything else has been attacking. So
absolutely
why the priests?
So, well, you're talking about liberation theology, aren't you? That was a later thing. But it was definitely the case in Spain, you know, throughout the period of anarchist evolution. They called it the idea that the church and the priests, the church in particular, was solidly allied with the bourgeoisie and the ruling class. And the anarchists wanted to change everything. I mean, they didn't marry. It's in my book, if you want to read that. They didn't marry. They formalized their relationship with the trade union. I know it sounds very odd. I mean, incidentally, these were trade unions that were – I mean, one of the problems perhaps with the revolution was that the people who were running the trade union were very, very poorly paid and perhaps stronger and better people could have been found. But, I mean, that was one – that was one of the problems. The other problem was that they were extremely principled. So they had the opportunity to take over the government, and they didn't do it. They said, we're anarchists. We don't take over the government.
Well, leaving it for someone else to take it over. Franco, for example.
Well, Franco, they could have fought off. But actually what happened was that the mice came out of the woodwork. The old bourgeois government turned up again, and they started to negotiate with Stalin. They sent all of Spain's gold to Stalin, which was a bit ironic. The story is in my book, because the people that were involved in the organization or coordination, if you like, Durruti and Ascaso and Oliveira, those people, they had been bank robbers. So they were actually in the trade, you know. But so the gold was sent to Stalin. Stalin then assured the Spanish bourgeoisie that if they joined the Communist Party, that the Communists would basically back them up. He didn't want a revolution. He wanted to crush the revolution. So therefore, the Spanish middle classes, property classes, flooded into what had been a very tiny Stalinist Communist Party. So to cut the story down a little bit, basically Stalin and everybody else armed either Franco was being armed by the fascists or the Republicans were being armed by Stalin, and both sides agreed that there would be no freedom for the workers and no revolution. There wasn't going to be a revolution. It didn't happen. And they successfully covered it up. One of the best books about the Spanish Revolution is called The Grand Camouflage by, I believe, if I can remember his name, Burnet Bolotin, who had been there. It's one of the greatest works of history. He's very well respected, you know. But he records how everybody wanted to cover it up and forget it ever happened.
You know what? This reminds me a little bit of things like Vietnam and even the situation in the Middle East with ISIS, where you've got what they call the hardening of the sides. So you get outside influences saying, well, there's this side or this side that you can be on, and really not talking about the middle, which is what most people ought to want to be on, no?
No.
Surely, you know, most people would...
I'm not going to agree with you.
...will be going towards either the Republican side or Franco, aren't
they? No, what happened in Spain is a lot of very, very ordinary, decent, good-hearted people rose up against fascism. As Orwell said, they drove Franco out of Aragon, and they were betrayed by all sides in the world and crushed. And it's a terrible story.
And well, somebody must have been going to Franco, and some people must have been going to the Republican side. They couldn't have done it with just people from outside Spain, surely.
No, I'm not sure of your point.
Well, I'm saying is that the main armed factions that ended up being the armed factions were those two sides. And so the people who were actually trying to create a revolution were stuck in the middle, really.
No, they weren't. They were the one side that drove Franco out. And then because they'd gained control of the street and were effectively in control of the country... The other forces in society, the propertied forces in society, the people that had been in government, the liberals, those people who weren't in a huge majority. I mean, they were probably 50-50, you know. But that's quite a high number if you think of people that were really committed to a total revolution was perhaps 50% of the population. It's quite massive. But the story is that the revolution, real revolution, and I think it's always the case, the same thing happened in the Soviet Union with Lenin crushing the worker collectives. Revolution isn't permissible because the state and power and authority will take over.
Anyway, the book's called The Beautiful Season, The Story of the Spanish Revolution by Bristol resident Roger Yates.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Hello, I'm Angela Balassi. I've been away for a little while, but I'm back speaking to Tony Gosling about the EU and the referendum coming up on June 23rd.